Hello there, and welcome to the Thinking Fellows podcast. My name is Caleb Keith, and today I am joined by Bruce Hillman, Scott Keith, and Adam Francisco. Changing up the order for those listening at home. The Thinking Fellows.
I've noticed that not only did you drop the moniker Doctor from my name, which we all agree to, which is fine, but you also dropped my title as your father from my introduction.
I just, you know, let's just get rid of all status.
Okay.
You know, let's just plan.
Yes, patriarchy. / hierarchy, the world is flat.
I have refused to do that since technically I could fire every single one of you I wanted to, so nope.
I figure if people don't realize you're my father when the last name thing comes up.
We could be brothers.
Oh, wow.
Sorry, go ahead with your introduction.
My gosh. The Thinking Fellows is brought to you by the 1517 Podcast Network. You can go to 1517.org/podcasts. to see all of our shows there. I want to thank you to all of you who partnered with us for our Giving Tuesday campaign at 1517. We raised $200,000 for Giving Tuesday, which is pretty amazing. You know, I don't want to sound greedy, but it doesn't end there, really. 1517 has continuing financial needs, and Giving Tuesday is sort of part one of our end of year need, which is around a total of $400,000. So we still have $200,000 to raise this December. If you would like to still support this show, if you haven't yet and you've been thinking about it, we would greatly appreciate that. You can follow the Support This Show links there. You'll be taken to a donation page where you can see some more information about 1517, the amount of resources we've created this year, the amount of people who have listened to shows, just to give you a glimpse at that a little bit. This year, your support, your partnership with 1517 and 1517 Podcasts in particular went to create over 1,000 episodes of podcasts in 2023, which is pretty incredible. Those shows had 5 million downloads this year. They were listened to 5 million times, whether those were old backlog shows or brand new shows in that 1,000. The message of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins was through and through those episodes this year, and I appreciate your support and your partnership with us to make that happen. Well, we are doing a multi-episode series here, and it's going to be about science. I've been thinking about this one a lot, and obviously a lot of science talk would have been very popular during the COVID years because there was a lot of trust the science, believe the science, getting tossed around there. But in the wake of that, more and more as I watch the kinds of videos and content and listen to the kind of content I like online, for me, that's usually cycling and coffee.
Man, don't watch one thing on YouTube that's going to take you off of that, or it'll take you down some rabbit holes you never intended to go.
That is true. I hear the phrase, the science, over and over and over again. And the thing that's funny about this is I listen to specifically a handful of, you know, they would be called science-driven types of shows, whether it is for the...
Don't listen to Neil deGrasse Tyson video.
No. Okay.
Bruce loved Neil deGrasse
Tyson. He said science-type shows, Bruce.
No, science-driven. So, Bruce, like an example would be, some of the cycling stuff I listen to is about training that would be informed by data or research, right? Or some of the coffee stuff I'm interested in actually has to do with the research behind extracting the solubles out of coffee and how that works and stuff like that. The problem is I keep hearing the phrase, the science, and then let's say 2 months later, the science will say something different about coffee extraction or will say something different about
the health of
things. But yet, whatever it is, and we have the science, though. And so I realize there's, you know, and I think many people have, there's obviously a component here that isn't scientific when people are appealing to the science. So I thought we would do an episode today that kicked off this series called Trust the Science. We would ask some questions like, what is science? What is trust? Is the science a reasonable sort of phrasing or use or what is meant by it, and how does that interact with sort of our realm of theology is science replacing religion for people? Is our phrases like trust the science in that realm? So to open up today, I guess the big opening question is, what is science?
Is it, I think there are two questions. What is science and what is the science? And I don't think they're the same thing. As I understand it, and I don't claim to be an expert here at all, the one thing I, you know, my expertise on science is limited to the classes I was required to take in undergraduate and the reading that I've done on my own in my own time as a layman. But as I understood it, it was a process by which one maybe made a hypothesis, collected data, analyzed that data, tried to make a conclusion from that data, and then tried to see if that process was repeatable and whether or not the collection of more data and could repeat the process and come to the same conclusion. And once that could happen multiple times, one feels comfortable making a claim. That, as I understood it, was sort of the scientific process. When somebody says trust the science, it seems like they're just saying trust what some priest in a lab coat has told you is true and move along.
Yeah. I mean, science in sort of the popular route, so the versus the science, but just science is, you know, shorthand for referencing a inductive type of research that has to do with the material world and material observations, and I think tries to draw conclusions to help people operate in that world, or and then has offshoots, has sort of mechanical sciences, technology is in the sciences, medicine is in the sciences, and tries to make conclusions based off of research, observations, repeatable observations.
That's interesting. When we used to lecture together at the university, Dr. Soper used to tell the class that what they conceive of as science is typically just technology.
I think most people do, yeah.
And that's not the same thing.
No, it's not. And a lot of technology doesn't actually go through the same type of research as it does sort of maybe a discovery phase that is also inductive. But I think, it gets included insofar as there, there can be a research component to this, which is sort of testing.
Sure. So I'd say that technological developments come by means of the scientific process. And so sort of the technology that you hold in your hand is a pretty good representation of somebody going through some process that's linked to that inductive method where they're trying this and trying that and seeing what will work, and even doing the engineering and mathematical work to ahead of time before you build the thing, see if it's even possible. That's all very much within the realm of scientific process, but the sort of thing that you get out of that process and the in terms of technology is the piece of technological material that's in your hand, the iPhone, the computer, the TV, the headset, the podcast recording device, the car.
Medical breakthroughs,
whatever. And in my opinion, as far as we sort of refer to science in the vernacular, sort of the modern way of speaking about it, that's actually still some of the kind of purest science that you can refer to, as opposed to what a lot of conjecture about, you know, worldwide phenomenons and this type of thing that is labeled as science.
So I think people are so used to getting the products of scientific research, whether they're technological, whether they're medical, or maybe even advice in certain other realms. You're used to getting the products that then the reference. And I think this is where the science begins to have an origin before we get to sort of the problems with that phrase as it gets used. But I think the science is used as a shorthand to have to not explain the body of research that came to a conclusion in this that then led to another body of research or whatever. It's just a shorthand to say, I have a product. The way I got that product, whether the product is knowledge, something physical in my hand, whatever, is the science, which is an all-encompassing phrase to try to shorthand the types of research or methodology that were used. Now, I think that gets misused, but I think ultimately that is what it's trying to shorten or describe. I don't know. Does anybody agree or disagree with that?
I was just thinking when you're talking about, you know, behind and driving some of the science, and it's always also a temptation of regular science, is a sort of God complex that can creep mm-hmm. in, where you think because of the disclosure or the revelation that science brings about the natural world and the technology that it creates, that, you know, you don't really need God, or you can kind of act like God. And it reminded me, it's actually of like the story in scripture of the Tower of Babel, where, so some linguists will actually say that language is a technology, especially like computer languages. They're a made up technology, but also the way human language actually functions, it functions like a technology. It evolves, it adapts, it communicates, it does things. So if you think of language just as the metaphor of being a technology, and you think of the Tower of Babel story, it kind of, to me, is a parallel, because it's like, well, we have this one language, so we don't need God now. Right. You know, we can just go do our own thing. And I think that happens a lot with the science. It becomes a way to make sense of the world and human agency, where you go, I don't really need a God, because I've been empowered by science. It's in our hands to, we don't need revelation. We need discovery. You know, I love Star Trek, but that's kind of the whole thing behind Star Trek, is like, you know, God, you just, you know, you go out and explore and find
until there is, and it's just a more advanced alien.
That's true. That was Deep Space Nine, but anyway.
Well, it's Deep Space Nine. That's Q. That's,
yeah, Q. Well,
that's you know, the progenitors of all life in the galaxy, and that one episode where they go on, you know, it's all that.
Now,
The problem with all this is that we were kind of doing this before the show. You can always ask questions that kind of get you one step back, one step back, one step back, and all of a sudden you find out that this isn't replacing God. This is just sort of becoming like a demigod. And if you ask questions back, there's no answers other than, you know, there's some
how did the mechanics of evolution,
some mechanism, you know, before all this. I mean, this was always one of the easiest creationist critiques of Big Bang Theory, right? It's just, okay, great. Where did the elements come from? Where did the energy come from to produce the movement, to produce the collision, to produce the bang? You know, it's just all of this can just go back. Adam, I was going to wait for Adam to say something, because Adam's just staring quizzically at the screen.
I had a prompt for him, unless he has something to say now.
No, go ahead. I was just holding in a sneeze.
In theology, we often talk about sources of authority, especially this comes up for Protestants as we identify sort of the primary sources of authority in sola scriptura, and then sort of these then list of authorities that help you learn or will pass down knowledge to you, like tradition and maybe even reason, which might encompass science, is in there, and things like that. It seems to me that also one of the other things the science becomes, instead of just this shorthand for the body of research, is an appeal to science as a unique or the primary source of authority for our culture, of which should be obvious to everybody, because we all are the benefactors of the products of, you know, the science. And so it gets used to have this, I think, unique grasp on objective research and fact. But Adam, I think you deal a lot with on Faith and Reason Exchange, and also as a historian, that science is not the only research discipline or academic discipline that has an attempt at objective research embedded in its sort of fundamental principles.
Or a methodological process that tries to get the conclusions as objective as possible.
So what ways does it differ from historical research, theological research, or does it differ in only in that it's about the material world?
Interesting. That's a really interesting and, I may add, loaded question, not in a, like a negative sense, but because if you look at the term science, it's rooted in the Latin scientia or scientia, depending on how you pronounce your C's, which just means knowledge acquired from investigation. So theology was, up until the early modern period, considered a science. History, there still is this kind of, I guess it's probably petered out, but in the 19th century, one of the big debates amidst historians was the study of and production of histories scientific, or, you know, a science, or was it an art, or something in between? Because there was this, in history, there's a German scholar, Leopold von Ranke, who proposed that the task of the historian in the modern age, and he was a 19th century guy, was to write history. I'm trying to remember what the German was. Wie es eigentlich gewissen, as it actually happened. Because so much history before that was, you know, certainly based on historical evidence, but filled in a lot of the gaps. And for von Ranke and these, you might call them more positivist type historians, they thought that the task of the historian was simply just to describe the past in such a way that it corresponded to all the facts that we have of the past. And if that's what history is, if there's no contemporary human element that is describing the past in a way that's moving or has some sort of rhetorical purpose, then you could describe history as a science. Problem is, it never works out that way.
And
the historians science like scientists, well, historians like scientists have to make judgment calls. And there's a larger context. There's a tradition that's handed to them that creates, if you will, like boxes that they work in. Or think of let's not do any sort of politics here as much as your dad and I might want to. Think of COVID and vaccines and all these, you know, masks and so on and so forth. I've got pretty strong feelings about some of this stuff, but if you're trying to put the best construction on things, you know, the narrative was that this thing was going to kill us all. I mean, that's hyperbole, of course, but, and so you can kind of...
It's not that much hyperbole.
Well, true, but I mean, I'm trying to be careful. You know, I'm trying to be scientific here. but it's this like emergency situation. So you can kind of, if you're trying to be sympathetic, I'm not really interested in being sympathetic, you can understand why they may have rushed into things and overcalled things. And this is the problem with contemporary science, or the science as we've been referring to it, is it becomes this, as Scott put it, a demigod, or this authority that, especially in a culture that cannot think critically, that is so used to just sort of Googling something for a quick answer, can be extremely dangerous.
Well, and it double folds over itself sometimes, right? Like with the issue of the vaccines, prior to the pandemic, people were like, well, a vaccine has to go through this rigorous scientific process before it's determined to be safe for use, blah, 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 blah. And then in the pandemic, it was, well, yeah, we're not going through that rigorous process, but we should trust the scientists. They wouldn't give us something that would be dangerous for us. So it can fold over on itself. And if you stand back, dispassionately and just approach it critically, you're going, well, which one is it? Is science part of a rigorous process, or is science about trusting the scientists?
Trust the science has become like trust the Bible, right? And this is the problem. It's got a religious aspect to it, or a belief aspect to it, that is more similar to having faith in something than it is being convinced of something by virtue of the data, and then being reasonably sure you can move forward in a way that's going to produce a semblance of truth or be effective or anything like
that.
Well, let me finish. The thing that I think is similar here between sort of like trust the science and trust the Bible or even the corruption that's happened in science and the corruption that has that obviously happened even within Christianity, you have two things that happen. The politicians kind of get a hold of it, and it becomes a play for political power, that uses these two things, the Bible and science, in order to gain more power. And two, you have, once that happens, you can't actually encourage people to look at the thing for themselves anymore. And this happened, of course, with the Bible, and it has now happened, of course, with science. You can't encourage people to look at the data themselves. You instead have to tell them to defer to your chosen set of interpreters, priests, theologians, monks, scientists, social scientists. Don't put those two in the same category, by the way. So, scientists and social scientists, and the like. And then once you do that, now you're told to believe something that isn't, that you're not actually told why you should believe it, other than an appeal to authority of the person that supposedly knows better than you do if you were allowed to look at the data. One of the things that the Reformation did is that all of a sudden other people got a hold of the data, right? And things changed. Now, whether you think they changed for good or for bad, that's kind of beside the point. They changed. We almost need that same sort of reformation in the way we look at science.
It's probably not an almost. It's certainly we need a reformation of science.
We can no longer be told to just believe the priests. The police have been, in many, many cases, corrupted by the politicians, and they're complicit in a play for power in a way that is not even part of their own training, their own education.
Well, can we add this, which is, I think one of the reasons the appeal to science has been so strong was it was timed well with a shedding of religion. We could say religion is biased. It's culturally loaded. It belongs to particular groups of people and not others. Science is agnostic of all of these human issues. It's material. It's materialistic. It has no feeling, emotion, morals. And so if we then set aside groups of people to investigate that, no values will come from that, just information. The problem is that you have this set of people there who have values, have presuppositions, have conclusions that they want, down to even if their research is good, asking the questions like, why did you want to research this particular topic in the first place? You could do that with theologians and historians too, right? Every single one of us have studied an area of interest that's personally important to us.
A pretty easy way to figure out whether or not this is still the case would be to sort of line up 100 random scientists and medical professionals and social scientists and ask, I'm not trying to channel Matt Walsh here too much, but and simply ask them what defines a woman.
Yeah.
And have them give you see how many out of that 100 give you a biological answer.
Right.
If it's not 99 out of 100, I mean, honestly, if it's not 100 out of 100, you have a problem. But if it's not 99 out of 100, you have a real problem here. You now have to admit that science, just like religion was, has been co-opted by culture and by sort of the politicians that benefit from these cultural corruptions.
But it's still not purely trustworthy on its own, even if it hadn't been corrupted yet. So like a great example is everybody knows about low sodium diet recommendations, right? Well, the guy who started sort of the really popular research on that, research in 1962 that's still used today to set guidelines by the WHO. And
that's hilarious, by the way. That's
and the FDA.
So in 60 years, we haven't produced.
Oh, we've produced thousands and thousands of.
But that we supplement. Yeah. You know, the original finding.
This guy had a psychological disgust of people who put salt on their food before he did the research. Now, that doesn't innately mean the research is bad, but it's certainly interesting when you ask the question when other research happens. I also think the phrase "the science" acts like there is always only one body of research. And actually what it refers to
is always consent, you know, mutual consent. Everybody agrees, believes the same thing.
It refers to the preferred body of research. If I was a scientist today, I would be extremely frustrated because the odds that you do genuine research in an important field that people care about today, say environmental research, say food and dietary, say medical research, the idea that your discovery will be judged based on the merits of your research is probably laughable and probably for many scientists, I'm sure, extremely frustrating, because there's likely in your field already a preferred set of conclusions and body of research that simply by better research or good counter research is not going to be overturned. And so when you ask the question of what are you trusting when you trust the science, we're not even trusting research anymore. You're trusting a preferred or selected conclusion that probably has some research behind it.
I found a thing from a paragraph which I found helpful, which I want to read from the NCSE. I didn't know who they were. They're the National Center for Science Education. They're an anti-creationist organization. So they
have a position.
Yeah. But I actually found what they said here to be very interesting. They have a little section on their website on theory versus fact. And they bring up two misconceptions. And the two misconceptions are this. Misconception one, evolution is just a theory. Misconception two, theories become facts when they are well supported and or proven. And they have this little explanation, which is kind of amazing. It says, there are three important misconceptions propagated in our two statements. The first statement implies that a theory should be interpreted as just a guess or a hunch, whereas in science, the term theory is used very differently. The second statement implies that theories become facts in some sort of linear progression. But in science, theories never become facts. Rather, theories explain facts.
Yeah.
The third misconception is that scientific research provides proof in the sense of obtaining the absolute truth. Scientific knowledge is always tentative and subject to revision as new evidence comes to light.
Then you can't be anti-creation. You have to say things like the current data has led to the theory that...
Well, Bruce is, I think, going to point out how their proposition one about theory then is not consistent with this, because they're going to say that theory is somewhere between a guess and a fact. It's this third category of knowledge where you have to operate based on it, but you must act as if it's
true. Well, you
true.
Call that inductive. I mean, yeah.
That theory is the accepted interpretation or explanation of the facts, which of course just means, I mean, it's calling something out for what it is. You know, I've had many, many conversations with science people or scientists who get very frustrated when a Christian will say something like, well, evolution is just a theory, because usually when Christians mean that, what they mean is it's just sort of a guess you've made up. But what the scientist means by that is it's the accepted explanation of the facts as we've read them. Well, okay, but that should cause some humility, especially the fact that science is always learning new things. But the science...
Supposed to be learning new things.
Yeah. The science is not humble usually at all. It's very rare. I mean, who would have thought, who would have imagined 20 years ago, maybe 15 years ago, that we would be reconsidering what Newtonian physics means in light of new breakthroughs in quantum physics? Like, who would have thought that Newton would be reevaluated, at least parts of him? So, like, science should hold itself with a high level of humility, but often it takes its theories and its accepted explanations of what it's come to conclude as being sort of eternal objective truths. And they're not. And one thing that also scientists hate is not just theology. They hate philosophers for this point. Yeah. Because like Scott said, you can always go, but why? But why?
I go to church with guys who work at the Fermi Lab, which specializes in particle physics, whatever that is. And the interesting thing with them is not only they also don't like scientists who make such grandiose claims. So,
yeah.
One of the interesting thing is when you spend time amidst Can we call them liberal-minded scientists? You know, those who are more classically minded scientists who regard science as a process that's evolving, for lack of a better term. Yeah. I think they would be just as critical of the science, and yet they're representatives of what science does, right?
I'm sure that's the case.
Well, I think there's a big difference between that and agency-driven science, which by agency I mean United States government agencies that make recommendations and pure facts on every single part of your life, and then because they don't want to say the government is telling you this fiat, they say, well, it's because of the science. They just want to push their authority back.
The politicians, I think so Fermilabs is a federal lab, Department of Energy. And so what those guys will tell you, like I've been doing these lectures on worldview at my church, and this one guy that is there, I learned after I'd done some stuff on cosmology, I was introduced to me as a guy who's working with the Del Webb Space Telescope.
I always have to ask that question ahead of time. I was asked two things. Are there any actual scientists in the audience, or are there any actual historians in the audience? If the answer to either one of those questions is yes, you really be careful. Well, if it's no, feel free.
In talking with him, two things that have struck me. One is he is very, extremely knowledgeable about his particular thing. And could be trusted in this. If he's describing what he sees in the data in such a way that his statements conform or correspond to the data, totally trustworthy. When he's speaking beyond that, he's very humble in confessing kind of ignorance and like, well, I don't know about this, that, and the other thing. In fact, the other thing that's really interesting about this particular person is he'll say, yeah, in science, in cosmology in particular, we know nothing. And now with the Del Webb Space Telescope, we're learning that we know even nothing about nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Last time I talked with him, he said, like, you know, when we want to sound like we know something about what's going on in the cosmos, we just suggest it's the result of dark matter. But we don't even know what dark matter is. So I wanted to throw that out there because
that's a good illustration, though, of how frustrating it is to listen to people on, you know, podcasts or radio or watch them on TV or YouTube, and they make these wild claims about what did happen, how many years ago it happened.
Yeah,
we know. It's infuriating because you know that they don't know in like the proper epistemological sense of knowing. I know that they believe these things, and I would just be much more comfortable. I don't care about their claims. Make these claims. I would just be much more comfortable if they would say, we believe that. That is so much different than saying, we know this.
And it's mostly in public forums, right?
Like, well, it's when you take your kids or your grandkids to some freaking museum or aquarium or something like that, or to some planetarium, and you're being told like exact time frames on things.
Well, like
how long ago this happened and what the exact biological process was, evolutionary process was, and exactly what they ate and exactly how they lived and exactly how they interacted with one another. And you're like, what? How the hell do you think you can know something like how some freaking dinosaur, which may or may not actually be exactly what you say it is, interacted with somebody with another thing before it wanted to mate? That is crazy. You've never observed this. This is all freaking conjecture.
I was going to bring that up. Like they did Apple TV did a dinosaurs thing that is supposed to be like, what was the planet one? The Big Blue Planet or whatever. But now dinosaurs. And the whole thing is, we now know that. No, you don't now know. You can't observe dinosaurs.
Doesn't this sort of suggest, though, the natural proclivity of human beings to create narratives?
Yes.
And fill in the
blanks. Reality.
Yes.
And may I say the importance of worldview and checking worldviews and worldview analysis and so on, because these things are powerful and they create, for lack of a better term, we've got friends who would balk at this term, but they create paradigms in which we live and work and have our being that we can't see past.
Right.
And eventually, though, those paradigms do shift.
Yep.
Science should be play a large role in shifting that, but that's the problem with the science.
Yeah.
In that it plays within the rules of the that are established.
The science.
Therefore, it becomes ideological.
Listening though to this whole podcast so far, and they're saying, "Okay, like I'm tracking with you, I'm following with you guys." But then, like, how do you guys personally, and but also, like, how do you prescribe anyone have confidence in any of the narratives or beliefs that they hold?
Well, I honestly would say, in any of the beliefs they hold, that's an interesting question. But kind of staying on topic, on like scientific claims. I would teach people to just be careful to recognize certain use of language that is inconsistent with what is actually science. So when somebody makes the claim that they know something that is absolutely not observable and cannot be found out by a mathematical equation to some degree of certainty, they don't know that. They may think that.
Well, I think you have to ask that question, right?
Like, that.
How does somebody needs to be in the position of where they're, because you're operating on even this assumption that somebody is analyzing scientific data and saying, oh, how could they know that? Like on the dinosaur thing, a lot of people aren't thinking, well, that's not observable. So first step.
That's why I started teach them to.
Yeah. The first step is sort of knowing that the principles of science yourself, and probably not just like what you remember about hypothesis testing conclusion from middle school.
It's funny, you listen to Adam, the resident historian in the room, and he'll say within history, even if you're really careful, the best historian has to fill in some blanks when telling the story of what happened in the past.
And not just some, but a whole lot.
Yeah.
I'm not a historian, but I might debate you on how much, depending on how far we go back, right? But right. If Adam can't say that he knows pretty definitively what happened 60 years ago, 70 years ago, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, based on the available evidence, which is certainly more abundant than something that you're claiming occurred. What's the current number? 7 billion. I mean, when I was a kid, we were in the hundreds of millions, and I know now we're into the billions as far as how old something is. I have a theory as to why we keep making everything take longer, but that's for another podcast.
A theory, really?
Yeah, it's
a theory. I guess
I have a hypothesis.
How does someone avoid the feeling that all belief is arbitrary because you can't really know anyway?
Not all belief is arbitrary.
No, I know. Someone who feels that way, how do you
manage to? Yes.
You interrupted me. I was in the middle.
It was taking too long.
I was like, you teach people how to reason. Okay. Adam brought this up earlier. People, we live in an age where people emote and feel, and they make conclusions based on emotions and feelings, and they have not been taught how to think through process and how to critically analyze anything. And so they go to the museum or they go to the aquarium and somebody gets on the speaker and says, 5 billion years ago, this fish buried itself in the sand and it walked out as an alligator. And they're like, well, that guy seems really smart. No. No, just because somebody sounds smart doesn't mean that they're right. And you have to sort of stop for a second and analyze why they're making that claim, how they're making that claim, what the evidence is for that claim, and go from there. I mean, at the end of the day, while we started out being a little bit critical of the science and some scientists, people need to relearn the freaking scientific method to be able to analyze some of this. At one point, this was something that was part and parcel with even just a high school education.
I think the humility that goes along with that was learned in philosophy courses, especially
Amen.
Section on epistemology
Amen.
And so on. And all that's not, I mean, this is going to sound hyperbolic, but it's being thrown out the window as colleges move further and further away from sort of a classical liberal arts approach to education. So all you have is like these silos that might specialize in something, but they lose the forest for their particular tree.
And before somebody gets on this, this applies to theology too. I mean, I used to give a lecture quite frequently called the Epistemology of Theology that ended like this. A good theologian stops where the text stops, period. Because in our line of work, if you accept that the Bible is the inspired word of God, the only data you then have to draw from is the text of Scripture. And so when you make conclusions, you try really, really hard not to make conclusions that cannot be supported from the text. Or to say it positively, you only make conclusions that can definitively be supported from the text and be defended from the text. And thus, a good theologian stops where the text stops. I would say a good scientist stops where the data stops.
But, and Bruce, to answer your question, that is hard to know if somebody did that, right? Because you don't have as much. You have better access to the claims of theologians, which people say are harder to peg down or harder to change or more immovable or less understandable because they're not tangible. You have more access to judging the value statements that a theologian makes, if it's from the Bible, than you do science. And in fact, there's less variance, right? There are probably fewer commentaries on the Gospel of John, which there's probably millions of them, than there are scientific research papers on X given topic from various universities, various students, various employed scientists, various agencies, whatever. You'll never be able to read that whole body of research, which is why people make value judgments. I would say one of the steps that I would apply to people that doesn't just have to do with relearning how to think, which I think you do need to do. There's probably some good books out there. Knowing how to know what you know or knowing why you know it is important, but is to slow down. Like, half these things don't actually require you to make a judgment. And if you don't, they don't affect your life in the ways that you think they do. And then sometimes when you're unsure if you can know something successful or not, life might just put you in a situation where you have to sort of roll the dice, right? Like, you don't know, for instance, like if something happens to you where you have a surgery, you don't know if it's going to be successful or not. So you have to say, well, my quality of life is bad or good or otherwise, and this could improve it or decline it. And I have to sort of have a relationship with the people who are telling me that. And so the trust is actually, so even in medical stuff, the trust is often not in the science, but in your doctor, your physician, who is either reputable or you have, experience with, who's helped you in the past, who's helped your children, who's got a reputation for solving your ailment or illness. And so some of it is based on that. Sometimes the facts or the research won't be plainly available to you, but maybe evidence of the success or trust in an individual will be. And that's a natural part of it. But on things that people are really worried about, like, climate change, people are really worried about this. Slow your roll. Your belief in this is not going to change the outcome, especially in the next 10 days. So if you don't have the mechanisms to actually understand if any of the claims are true or not, guess what? You have time to learn that. You have
the funny thing is, the more somebody is asking you to significantly change your behavior or your lifestyle based on a conclusion, the more important it is for you to know and to understand the data that led to that conclusion. The less they're asking you to change your lifestyle, your behavior, your beliefs, whatever, the less important it is for you to know exactly that. So you can go into a dinosaur museum and have them spout all this claptrap about what they know and they don't know from 6 billion years ago. And it's kind of like, so what? It's a little weird. Have a conversation with your kids on the way home about what people can know and not know. But when somebody's telling you that you have to give up your gas-powered vehicle because of the science, and now you have to, by 2025, own only an electric vehicle with the increased costs and range limits and how that'll affect your life and everything, you should, before you simply just nod your head and say, yeah, you're probably right, you should look into that. You should look into that before somebody tells you you got to start eating bugs and you can't enjoy a steak anymore because cows are ruining the planet. You should maybe look into that. Like, maybe before somebody tells you to get a new technology jammed into your body, you know, I'm not saying do it or don't do it, and I'm actually not taking a stand on either one, but you should maybe look into it further. Maybe you should get both sides of it.
And that might be, and I guess, Bruce, the other part to answer somebody's question is, sometimes when I hear people do that, like with a response like that, like how can I know anything, it's actually kind of covering for, I simply don't want to do the hard work of figuring out if this stuff is reliable or not. I just want somebody to, I want my life to be simpler. I just want somebody to tell me what's true or not. And I'm gonna go with what most people believe is true because that seems safe.
And if you really, really want some help with this, it's not that I want more speaking gigs in my life, but I do have a great lecture on this kind of thing called the Epistemology of Theology that I will come do at your church, that just walks people basically through how we know anything at all and the reality that we all do use an epistemological framework to decipher information, to make conclusions, and just teaching you to recognize what framework you are using, what has historically been used to arrive at something that Adam referred to earlier, a correspondence view of truth where the decisions you make actually correspond to the data that's available to you and to move forward from there. There are some big words in there, but this is something that can be done at the lay level if it's something that you did not get in your education already. And that 1517 has several people that could come help you do. Me, Adam, Bruce doesn't travel so much, but if you're in the driving area, Bruce could help with this. Caleb,
and
Dave Anderson.
Can I recommend David Anderson's book too?
Yeah.
Yes, please.
I love really it. Know. I actually love both his books, but go for it.
Yeah. What Can We Really Know? The Strengths and Limits of Human Understanding, which is a work on basic epistemology, mm-hmm. But then towards the end, he applies it to theology or the Christian worldview, you might say.
Get Dave to come talk at your church.
I would say to ask, if you also are prompted by this, I would say it's be proud of being a little more skeptical.
Yes.
Day to day, and that is scientific.
And don't turn it into cynicism.
And anytime you hear the phrase "the science," know that there's multiple things wrapped up in it, and one of the primary ones is an appeal to authority. And ask yourself, do I know which authority they're appealing to?
Yeah.
Is it a particular scientist? Is it a particular research paper? Is it a government agency? Is it whatever? And when you figure out who that source of authority is, maybe investigate them a little bit and check it past your other experiences in life.
That's like the first couple 20 minutes in this lecture that I do. Everybody appeals to some authority to something. The key is to know what authority you're appealing to and whether or not that authority can actually be trusted. And to go from that authority can be a holy book. It could be a set of data. It could be a person. Hell, it could be feelings. But you have to know what it is that you're appealing to make these decisions and whether or not it's an authority that can be trusted. And I just want, before we leave, I just want to say, I'm not, and to Bruce's question, I'm not encouraging people to be cynical and say, well, hell, we just can't know anything, can we? I am saying be skeptical enough of information that is handed to you, especially that type of information that is asking you to change your life fundamentally and dig deeper. Dig deeper. You live in the information age.
I rephrase your term, not that it's wrong in any way, but just to make it sound more positive, instead of saying be skeptical, be responsible with the data.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
This morning, gentlemen, and I thank you for listening to this episode of The Thinking Fellows. If you are looking for more content after you've finished this, if you liked this episode, you probably like Faith and Reason Exchange with Adam and David Anderson. So I'd go check that out right after this episode. We will catch you next time. Bye.